KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture, and welcome to the inaugural show for the fall quarter 2009 here on KZSU. I'm very excited to be back on the air, and I'm looking forward to a great schedule of guests coming up this semester. We're going to kick off our quarter with Annalee Newitz, who is a very prolific blogger and writer in technology. And we are going to be focusing our discussion today on female geeks, or nerds. I'll let Annalee choose the terms that she would like. We've had a number of women on the show who could be characterized as geeks. I'll leave it to them or to you perhaps to use that moniker. It is a moniker which the word geek may sound derogatory, and it can be a derogatory term, but I think it's often used with affection, and certainly I use it that way. And I describe myself as a wannabe geek, in the sense that I don't have a computer science background, but would like to have one for what I do. Annalee co-authored a book with Charlie Anders, who's not joining us today, co-edited, I should say, a book called She's Such a Geek, Women Write About Science, Technology, and Other Nerdy Stuff, a few years ago. She collected a wide variety of authors, all writing about their experience as women in and around technology, both as consumers, as young pre-adolescent and adolescent nerds, people working in the technology field, and really their experience as women in what is and remains not only a male-dominated field that is technology, but also society that in many ways favors men. And in these essays, these authors talk about their experiences, and not only their experiences, but really what they've learned and what they'd advise for the future. The book covers such areas as experiences dealing with early technology to women and girls in other kinds of areas like Dungeons and Dragons, right up through modern day online role playing games where men are dominating, and so forth. And all of the stories really boil down to the question of what differences and what issues may exist for women in technology. And it's a topic that we haven't discussed directly on the show, but one that I'm very excited to kick off the semester on today. She's Such a Geek has a few guests, a few authors who have been guests on the show in the past, including Wendy Seltzer, and a number of people that I think would make excellent guests for the future. And so with that, I'm very excited to start off the quarter by beginning our discussion with Annalee Newitz. Annalee, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And Annalee, you're joining us from San Francisco, and I thank you for joining us today. Let's start off really with more of your background. You've done quite a bit in this area, so I will leave it to you to talk about your background and what you're doing today.
Well, I started out back in the Stone Age studying mass media in academia when I was working on my PhD at Berkeley. And when I left academia and left teaching, what I did was, this was about 10 years ago now, I went into writing about technology for magazines and newspapers, and I got more and more interested in writing about not just technology itself, which was very exciting at the time, but also the sort of culture around technology, what we call geek culture, or nerd culture, depending on which of those terms is more comfortable for you. And what's interesting about, or what was fun for me about doing that, is that I was able to, because when you're writing about a topic from the outside, which I was, I mean, I'm not an IT professional, I'm a professional writer and journalist, you're able to make observations that it's hard for people within those fields to make about themselves just because they're so busy, you know, running experiments or, you know, trying to compile code or trying to ship the latest product. And so I think it's really to my advantage that I have kind of an outsider perspective, and I'm able to not just talk about issues around gender, which we're going to talk about a little bit today and which has been a preoccupation of mine, but also just issues around politics in the field, issues around how technology impacts people's personal lives as well as their social lives. All of that stuff has become really interesting to me, and so that's been kind of the focus of my work over the past decade.
And I know that, and it's a good thing to mention up front, that you're working on a new project now, IO9. What is that?
Right now, so for a while I was writing for Wired magazine pretty regularly, and I was writing for a lot of other magazines like New Scientist. And about 2 years ago, I started a blog called IO9, which is part of the Gawker Media Network, which is a large blog network that includes titles like Lifehacker and Gizmodo and Jezebel, which is a great feminist blog. And so I'm the editor-in-chief of IO9. It's a science and science fiction blog. We have about four other full-time people working on it, too, so we publish about every half hour. It's a pretty rigorous schedule. And I'm doing writing and editing for that, talking about a lot about science and a lot about sort of the future of science and how, you know, there's this kind of slowly more permeable membrane between what we think of as science fiction and what we think of as science. So if you come to the site, you'll find everything from straight, you know, movie reviews about the latest science fiction to stories about futuristic design and the latest experiments in genomics. So we try to have a nice mix of the science side and the fiction side.
And the site is the letter I, the letter O, and the number 9.
Right, IO9, just three characters.
And what? And out of curiosity, there must be a reason for that name. What is the reference?
Actually, we just made it up.
Better.
We made up a story about how IO9s were brain implants that allowed people to see the future, but it drove them crazy, so they were eventually outlawed. So now people who are IO9ers are kind of outlaw brain hackers who install weird hardware and software into their brains in order to see visions of what might come next.
So we just made up in
fine science fiction tradition.
Yeah, I was about to say. I mean, that's exactly what you're doing there, and we've immediately inside the first few minutes entered the geek realm. I think quite well.
Right.
So let's talk about the book. She's Such a Geek. For those that haven't seen the book, I think the first thing I want to ask you, and I do this with some authors, is actually about the cover of the book, which includes an image that actually perhaps I could describe as what appears to be a woman wearing aviator glasses, carrying some type of flamethrower looking device around her neck, wearing all black. And also carrying something, some kind of other weapon or something that points at things in the other hand. It's an unusual picture. So perhaps you could tell us about who this person is on the cover of She's Such a Geek.
Yeah, so when Charlie and I were first putting the book together with Seal Press, which is a great press that does books for and by women, they asked us, you know, what would be the one thing that would be unacceptable to have on the cover of the book? And I said, no pink robots, because one of the things that we were arguing against in this book is that the way to bring women into technology and into science is to make everything pink, you know, give them pink computers or pink robots. But what women really want is just, you know, kind of horribly cheesy feminized versions of what guys have. And so they came to us with a cover that had a pink robot on it. And it was a pink robot, like, wearing a bra. And we were both horrified. So we said, okay, we're just going to come up with an image for you that to us represents what we're trying to get at here. So we found this tremendously cool collection of photographs from the early 90s that somebody had taken at a British science fiction convention. And so the woman that you see on the cover really is a female geek. She was at a science fiction convention. She has a ray gun in one hand, and in the other hand, she has, I think it's supposed to be a Borg-like implant. Her arm is itself.
Oh, that's her arm. Okay, all right.
Weapon, and it's very homemade looking, and she's wearing these great go-go boots, and she really captured for me this image of female geekery that you almost never see in the media, where she's, you know, she's got these sexy boots on, but at the same time, she's also got all these traditional symbols of nerdiness that are usually associated with boys. And she has this very serious expression on her face as well, as if she's concentrating very hard on maintaining her nerd image. So we wanted to have that on the cover because we felt like it was the sort of person that rarely is seen in the media, but also who readers might identify with, male and female readers, because, you know, she embodies our inner nerd.
And I'm taking that you never actually were able to identify who she was or to speak to her about it.
We got permission from the photographer to use the image, but no, we never met her. So she's out there somewhere. I don't know if she even knows that her picture was used on this book at all, and we've never heard from her. So, you know, hopefully she fought and was excited. You know, that's my sort of dream, is that she was wandering through some bookstore in England and saw her picture and was like, wow.
Presumably she would be complimented by it. And, but yeah, but I
think so. She's one of us.
Right. Right. And the IP issues, I guess, are ones that, will be discussed off air in the context of, advice that, your publisher would have at any rate. So it would be an interesting issue from an IP perspective, but we're going to focus on She's Such a Geek from the perspective of what your authors have written. One of the things you said, even in introducing yourself, is a theme that runs through the book, and I think it's a good way for us to start our discussion. As I mentioned in the introduction, I mean, virtually all, or perhaps really all of the essays, in one way or another, discuss and talk about your author's personal experiences being judged as women in a field that is generally dominated by men. But a few of the authors say that they never wanted to be viewed as women per se, but as people that were interested in computers or had computer backgrounds or invented this or wrote that and what have you. I think you've indicated that as well in your introduction of who you are. How do you reconcile this in a book called She's Such a Geek?
Well, one of the things that was really instructional for me in putting this book together, because we got about, you know, 200 submissions for essays, so I read through a vast many more essays than you'll see in the book. And the thing that really stood out was that all of these women were in one way or another trying to redefine what it meant to be women, because they were working in or playing in fields that were traditionally male. They were male dominated. They're associated with boy culture in pop culture. And, you know, each of these women, you know, was dealing in a different way. And so there were two kind of, I'd say, dominant themes in how they responded. And I think you've put your finger on it, which is that some women really just wanted to blend into their surrounding culture. So say they were working in computer science. They just wanted to be viewed as another person in computer science. You know, some of them even would say that they wanted to be kind of one of the boys, or they were kind of tomboyish. They just felt like they wanted to be treated like another member of the group, and that no one would notice that they had breasts, or that they, you know, had slightly different upbringing because they'd been a girl. And other women really felt strongly that they wanted to hold on to what they considered to be femininity. And so one of the women in the book writes about how she loves to wear dresses, and it's just a really important part of her identity. And at the same time, you know, she's working in a field where there's a lot of sort of hiking out to remote locations in order to do astronomical observations. And, you know, everybody else in her group is wearing pants and rugged clothing, and she just prefers to wear dresses. And that's just her identity as a woman and as a person. And she really had, you know, a difficult time at certain points being taken seriously as someone who could carry equipment or could set things up, because she not only was a girl, but she was also heightening people's awareness of her womanhood by wearing feminine clothing. And she did end up feeling like she met the challenges and that she's a strong person and she was able to lift things, and she earned the respect of her colleagues. But it's hard for women when your environment is, you know, so male-dominated that you either have to kind of, in order to blend in, give up the signs of femininity, or you have to constantly fight for people to respect the signs of femininity that you want to hold on to. Now, for some women, like I said, like even for myself, like I don't mind not wearing dresses. I don't mind being one of the guys. I've always kind of been one of the guys, and that's comfortable for me. But for a lot of women who really like dressing up in dresses and wearing lipstick and wearing high heels, which can be fun, you know, that's not an option for them. Like, they can't just be one of the guys because it's uncomfortable. It's not who they want to be. And so we saw a lot of stories dealing with that. Like, do you choose to keep projecting a feminine image and deal with it? Do you shed that image? What are the consequences in the end when you do that? And the consequences are interesting. I mean, that's kind of a whole other story about what it means to either lose the image of femininity or maintain it.
Right, and that's I think that's, you know, where we're going. So I don't want to interrupt you much, but except to follow up with that point, is it a choice that women can easily make in this area, and how do they deal with the issue?
Well, like I said, I think it's a choice that, at least right now in history, and I think that things will be very different even in 5 years or 10 years as a new generation comes into the workforce. But right now I do think it's very much an issue. Pretty much every woman I know who's working in a nerdy field, whether they're working in comic books and writing science fiction or working in a biology lab or teaching in computer science departments, they've all at some point had to think about, okay, what kind of an image am I going to project? And part of thinking about that involves, do I want to try to downplay my femininity, or do I want to just stick with it and power through? And the consequences can be very personal. For example, a lot of women in the book and women's essays who we read who didn't wind up getting into the book talk about the problem of dating, because when they are at work, they feel kind of pressured to downplay all of the aspects of their identities and maybe how they look that in another context are the very things that make them attractive to men, or that make them feel attractive to men, which is really the more important thing anyway. And so it became this kind of, for a lot of women, it becomes a kind of tug of war. Like, will I feel attractive or will I feel respected? And men, I don't think, practically ever have to deal with that question. Like, when a man goes to work in a computer science department, he doesn't have to think, like, gee, will blending into the culture of my department mean that women cease to find me sexually attractive or that they cease to feel sexually attractive? I mean, I think nerdy men have a whole other set of issues around being sexually attractive, but it isn't gender presentation. It's other things. And I also think that as nerdiness becomes sexy in our culture because it's associated with power, I think men have this problem less and less. But, I think that, you know, especially for the women in the book and women that I've known who choose to remain, to present themselves in feminine ways, to wear dresses, to wear makeup, to behave in ways that are more feminine, that it becomes an issue because men around them will read what they're doing, will read that clothing and that look as somehow making them not part of the team, making them perhaps stupider or less competent because all of our stereotypes around femininity say that, you know, if you're feminine, you can't do science, or if you're feminine, you can't possibly, you know, step up to this intellectual task with rigor and, mm-hmm. and honor. So women have to do education about that, obviously, like in their workplaces, have to just basically teach by example that, yes, they're competent, even if they're wearing a skirt or even if they're wearing go-go boots, they can still do, you know, science with the best of them. And I think sometimes the opposite happens. You know, the environment crushes those women, and they feel like they can't be themselves, and they leave. And a lot of the women that are in the book, and this is something that was very disheartening for us, a lot of women said, you know, I just left. Like,
yeah.
You know, it wasn't, I didn't feel like I could be myself. I didn't feel like people would respect me. There's a lot of stories about women saying that, you know, the men in their lab groups would all go out to beer and not invite them, and not to be mean, but just because they didn't think, oh, she's not really one of us. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't really feel comfortable inviting her out because maybe it would be perceived as them making a pass at her, or who knows? Who knows why they did it? But a lot of the women did end up leaving for other fields because they just couldn't fit in.
We're talking with Annalee Newitz, co-editor of the book, She's Such a Geek, Women Write About Science, Technology, and Other Nerdy Stuff. You know, Annalee, I've been reading your work for a while on Techsploitation and other blogs. I also look back fondly when our friend and my former colleague Jennifer Granick pointed out Nerd Salon in San Francisco, and that Nerd Salon was going to be doing Roomba cockfights and video that appeared showing these battles, which I thought was hilarious, and I think many people in San Francisco and other people in technology probably find amusing, and a lot of people scratch their heads, and that scratching the head is something actually that I want to ask you about in a little more detail. You know, you mentioned that men may have it difficult for other reasons, and my interest is not to get into a who has it worse discussion, but rather to take a step back from it and wonder whether technology itself and the way technology has been viewed heretofore is largely the reason why women have this particular battle. In other words, I guess this is what I'm asking. There's no question that up until perhaps recently, but still, I mean, there's still the stereotype of the nerd and the geek, and I made light of it in the introduction, but it's a real issue. As everyone around computers, male or female, have to grapple with this issue, how does that overarching problem, the problem of the smart kid, okay, putting aside technology, which has always been an issue, making fun of the nerd, of the studious person, impact women dealing with these men who have had to deal with these issues as well? Several of the authors, and I think in your introduction, you talk about how, in fact, it was the male nerds or the male geeks who are making the problem worse by basically exemplifying the very behavior that they perhaps are victims of as well. As technology is viewed differently in society, as computers become more ubiquitous and things like Facebook make computer using much more widespread, you know, and obviously the use of it in business and so forth means that everyone has a computer on their desk. Do you see this changing? You've alluded to it a little bit, but perhaps we can discuss a little more detail.
Yeah, I definitely see it changing, and I think that you are right that part of what's changing it is the fact that computers are ubiquitous, and also the fact that they're being used for so many different things that they weren't used for anymore, including media exchange and, you know, viewing media, as well as social networking and writing on a regular basis and things like that. So I think that there's a lot more ways in for people to use computers. It's not just, you know, let's hack games or let's control robots or let's exchange porn, which is kind of what we did when I was a kid with computers. Right. And that might not necessarily be welcoming for all people. But
right.
I think to get back to your earlier question about how does the stereotype of the geek affect the way male geeks and female geeks interact? I think that's a really important question, because part of what my goal with this book was, and my goal with talking about these kinds of issues is just to get male and female geeks networking with each other, because I think that that's one of the big bridges that still needs to be crossed. And that, you know, when men ask me, well, how can I, you know, improve the ratio of women at my company, or how can I make sure that women feel comfortable, I always say, well, make sure that the men at your company, or make sure that the men in your lab, are mentoring women. Make sure that you're reaching out to women, that you're not just, when you have a job, that you're not just going to the same old network of dudes, because, you know, men tend to hang out together, women tend to hang out together. It means there's fewer connections between those networks, and it's, you need to actually take affirmative steps to reach out to that other network that you may not have as many connections with. You know, go to the Female Engineering Society, or put job posting ads at the all-women's Mills College here in the Bay Area, or something like that. But the other part of that is, I think that between male and female geeks, especially over the past, say, 30 or 40 years, there's also kind of a wall of sort of mistrust, or maybe you could even say fear, that has built up, because so many young men who are drawn to science and technology and nerdy things, even gaming or something like that, do get stigmatized when they're kids. In a worst-case scenario, they're picked on and told that they're not manly, basically, that they're not living up to what they should be doing as boys. You know, they're not out playing sports. They're not beating the crap out of each other. Instead, they're staying home and writing lines of code, or experimenting on yeast bacteria. And that still doesn't fit our image of what a young boy should be doing and what a man should be doing. Although I do think, again, that that's changing very quickly. And so as a result, a lot of male hacker culture, a lot of male nerd culture, I think becomes extremely macho in response to that experience of kids of being told that they weren't manly enough. And so if you go to, say, a hacker conference, like a computer hacker conference like DEF CON, which is a big conference that happens every year in Las Vegas, where people get together and share stories about interesting discoveries they've made about how to sneak into computer networks or protect computer networks against being hacked into, the culture is, it feels like a frat. I mean, it feels like a lot of guys getting together, drinking beer, going out to strip clubs, and, you know, reveling in a kind of boys club atmosphere that they were told that they couldn't have as kids because they were defective boys. So now that they're grown-ups, you know, what they really want to do is feel like guys. And the thing is that part of traditional guy culture, where you get together and drink beer and go to strip clubs and shoot guns, and these are all things that people actually do at DEF CON, you know, part of that culture is having a sign on the outside of the clubhouse that says no girls allowed. And I think probably, if you were to ask most of the men who are involved in this culture, gee, wouldn't you like women to be part of your culture? Almost all of them would say yes. I don't think that they are consciously and deliberately thinking to themselves, we hate women, we don't think women belong here. It's just that they've chosen to embrace the kind of culture where women don't feel welcome, and they're not interested in changing the culture to make it into something that would be more welcoming to women, because they're so excited to finally be these macho hacker computer dudes who are just so cool that they're, you know, breaking into computers, which is a very manly thing to do, because you get to, like, penetrate ports and, like, you know, pop the cherry on a box and all that kind of stuff. And so, I do think that that's changing, but I think that there's also that when boys are growing up nerdy, they are being sent messages by their culture that kind of creates this very macho computer culture when they grow up.
We're talking with Annalee Newitz, co-editor of the book She's Such a Geek, Women Write About Science, Technology, and Other Nerdy Stuff on KZSU-FM Stanford's Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is a show that is on a station which is both nonprofit and non-commercial. KZSU relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, and you will get a prompt and happy response. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to KZSU and to Hearsay Culture. Annalee, you said a lot there, and I think, you know, in dealing with these issues, we can drill down on a couple of examples of where these gender issues do arise. And one of the big challenges, and it, again, is referenced by several of the authors in the book, is parenthood. And reconciling a professional career in parenthood is a major challenge, not only for women, but increasingly it's a challenge for engaged fathers. And, you know, as the father of a 3-month-old and a 2.5-year-old, it's something I think about a lot. As you know, what observations do you have there, with the focus being that as men take on more of these domestic roles that were previously reserved for women, is that another example of the possibility and a hopeful view that attitudes will change in this area because the gender roles are being blurred in areas totally unrelated to technology?
I think yes. I think actually nothing makes me happier about the future than, you know, hearing about the shift toward men having 50% of the caretaking time with kids. You know, traditionally and still, you know, women tend to have get saddled with the lion's share of childcare, and in the sciences and in especially people who are pursuing academic careers in the sciences, having to take several years off to raise a kid at basically the most important time in your professional career, it is really a career killer. And it's something that countless women have found. It's not so much that there's this glass ceiling, there's this baby-making pit that they fall into, where if you want to have kids, which apparently most people do, you know, then you really don't have much of a choice but to put your career on hold for a lot of women. So I think that as men are taking on the role of maybe even primary caretaker for kids in some cases, but certainly as co-caretaker, it's going to allow women in these male-dominated fields to continue to be as productive as they need to be, you know, producing research, getting grants, writing papers, building new pieces of interesting hardware, pushing products out to market, all the things that they need to be doing to be earning the respect of their colleagues and to be, you know, advancing technology and science ahead. And it's interesting that you say that it's kind of, that this is a development that's not in the realm of technology, because mm-hmm. I actually think the shift toward men having more childcare responsibilities is in some ways a result of the progress of technology, because mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. More men are able to telecommute and work from home. And have professional middle-class jobs, but at the same time also do childcare. And I think that that's a relatively new historical phenomenon. And also, couples are able to have children at a much later age when their careers are much more advanced, so it isn't as inhibiting on the woman's career to have babies. And again, that's completely the result of biotechnology. I know so many women now who have kids in their 40s because they get egg donors, or they have, you know, fertility treatments or other kind of crazy frozen sperm in space and stuff like that. They aren't really from space. You know what I mean? They're reaping the benefits of biotechnology in order to have better careers for the women. So that all of that to me is just so exciting, and I think that kids who have primary caretakers who are dads or who have dads that take care of them 50% of the time are going to be much happier kids and much more well-rounded, and they're going to, you know, think of men in a really different way than the previous generation.
Oh, I agree with you. I think I probably wasn't clear. What I meant was is that we see changes in gender roles in areas other than the technological realm itself.
But I
take your point.
I think it's a very good point. Technology, but partly just changing ideas, of course.
Oh, it makes look. I mean, I say on this show that I'm recording from the East Coast studios of KZSU, and that's my hopefully humorous way of saying I'm recording from home. I have a home studio, and it allows me the opportunity to spend a little more time with my children. Anyway, I head upstairs, and I can see my kids, and head into work. And so I totally take that point, and I think it's an important one, and I think it also gets us to a question that I really want to make sure that we have time to discuss. I don't have daughters. Perhaps, God willing, in the future I will. I don't know. But what would you say to, and what advice would you have for, let's say, a 12-year-old young woman who considers herself a geek? How would you advise her to proceed? What words of wisdom would you offer to her to deal with this thicket?
I think anytime someone's a geek, you know, whether they're male or female, especially at, you know, that age where everything is very intense and confusing, the very best thing to do is to find communities of other geeks. And it's very lucky that at least for people who are in, you know, middle class, you know, environments, it's pretty easy to get access online to groups of people who are interested in geeky stuff. And even if you don't have a computer at home, usually schools have computers with internet connections and libraries have them. And you can find, you know, groups of people who are interested in all kinds of stuff, like making robots or, you know, doing home observation of the night sky and how to build a better telescope or how to find constellations or how to have a home chemistry set, for example. Make Magazine, which is a really great resource, especially for people who are young, who are interested in getting into science, Make Magazine has a whole line of home chemistry kits and home electronics experiments kits that you can find through their website at makezine.com. And it's a great way for kids to learn about this stuff. In a lot of cities, there are also classes that kids can take that are aimed specifically at getting them interested in this stuff, or if they're already interested, to teach them about how to, you know, make a circuit board or, I mean, how to make a circuit using a board and how to, again, build robots. There's a lot of, like, robot-oriented stuff aimed at kids. And here in San Francisco, we're incredibly lucky that we have a ton of different places where kids can go to learn everything from metalworking to, you know, electronics. And so that's, I mean, having a community of geeks is the way to survive being a geek as a kid. That's how I survived. That's how almost every other nerd I know survived, is knowing, yes, there's other people out there that want to read books about spaceships and want to hack computers and want to, you know, play with synthetic biology. And that, you know, is something that parents can really help with, is letting their kids have access to that stuff online and access to classes in the summer or during the year.
And I think
that would be my big advice.
And it seems, you know, and obviously it goes without saying that the social networking abilities of the internet today make finding this community a lot easier, because while I have no doubt that San Francisco would be a place where this would be relatively easy, in a lot of places in the country, this would still be something quite difficult to find and therefore to nurture. You know, similarly, it's probably related, so I don't want to ask a repetitive question, but, you know, parents dealing with this issue as well, and trying to encourage their daughters to pursue, you know, the hard sciences or technology. Your book is replete with authors talking about advice that they got as children, and are all variations on the theme of you don't need to know this, all you need to do is make babies and know how to cook meals. And I know several, including my mother, who have stories about guidance counselors and others basically telling them the same thing when they were considering pursuing their dreams in technology or otherwise. So what advice beyond don't do stuff like that to your daughters do you have for the parents of that same 12-year-old female geek?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it is similar to what I was saying about, you know, what the young geek should do, which is that, I mean, especially when you're, if you're 12 or if you're still, you know, under, say, 17 or under 16, it's difficult to get access to a lot of these geeky communities without your parents helping you and without your parents supporting that. And so I think if a parent wants to make sure that their daughter is exposed to these kinds of things, it's a great idea to, you know, have them take summer classes where they learn about science in a fun way and learn about science in an applied way. There's a whole movement now of people who do crafty type stuff with science, like making clothing that has electroluminescent wire in it, or making animatronic stuffed animals, where it's something that's fun and artistic, but also teaches you about how circuits work. It teaches you about how, you know, photons travel, all kinds of other cool stuff like that. And so when I was growing up, for example, like lots of kids took art classes in the summer or took, you know, fun classes like that. And I think that that's what parents should be aware of, is that girls don't just want fun art classes. They don't just want to learn dance. They also should be exposed to learning about how to build a computer, or learning about how to do chemistry and how fun that can be. And so I think parents just need to remember that girls and boys, when they're growing up, should be exposed to the same kinds of things, in the same way that, you know, girls should also be exposed to sports and should be given the opportunity to play baseball or football or whatever, or soccer. You know, and boys should be allowed to take ballet. You know, kids need to be exposed to a wide range of ideas so that they can figure out later what they want to do. And I think for a lot of women, including myself, kind of the tragedy of our childhood wasn't that we were told, you know, you are dumb, you shouldn't do science, but simply that we weren't given an opportunity to enjoy science, and that we weren't exposed to science as regularly as our male counterparts were. And so, really, I mean, a lot of it is just about making sure that your kid knows that science is fun and that science is something that they can do. It's not something that only men in white coats can do. It's something that you can go to the community center and do with, like, a soldering iron or just with a circuit board and a couple parts. So it's all about familiarizing girls with science and making them see that it's something that's within their capability.
We're talking with Annalee Newitz, co-editor of the book She's Such a Geek. Women write about science, technology, and other nerdy stuff on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, Annalee, as you were giving that advice, I realized that probably the toughest advice question I can ask, but I'm going to ask it because it actually has personal resonance, is how, what would you suggest as advice for raising boys so that those boys don't perpetuate the problems that you identify in the book? Again, I have two young boys, a 2.5-year-old and a 3-month-old, who look at their daddy right now as the exemplification of what they should be doing as boys. And even my 3-month-old is slowly starting to look around and look, but my 2.5-year-old does that all the time. I was fortunate that I have a younger sister, and I think I learned a lot just about relating to girls just by having a younger sister. For the parents of boys, what do you recommend so that we can have a, as you mentioned, the generational changes, we can have a future that doesn't include this kind of gender stereotyping?
Well, I think partly it does involve what we've already been talking about, which is making sure that fathers are doing at least 50% of childcare. And that means, you know, taking the kids out to the park or taking them to a cool science class or taking them to the movies. When I was growing up, my father did probably more, actually, of the childcare than my mother did. She had much longer working hours. And I did grow up thinking that it was natural that men would do things like cook and housework and things like that because my dad did it. And so I think one way to do it is just to lead by example and do cooking with them and show them that cleaning the house is something that boys do too, or that, you know, you can use a Roomba vacuum cleaner and hack the Roomba vacuum cleaner to do vacuuming for you, whatever is exciting for you as a house cleaner. But I think the other thing goes back to something I was mentioning much earlier about networking between men and women. And I think one thing that fathers can do with their sons is make sure that their sons do have playmates of both genders and make sure that you're seeking out playdates with girls and boys and exposing your kids to both genders as much as possible and keeping them in mixed gender groups as much as possible, because the more that boys think of girls as their allies and as their comrades and as their co-adventurers, the more that the adult men they become will look at women as colleagues and not just as potential sex objects and not just as alien creatures who they don't understand. And, I mean, in a way, it's kind of what I was saying about exposing girls to science. You know, make sure that girls are exposed to science. Make sure that boys are exposed to girls who are doing science. And I think that those kids will grow up being a lot more comfortable with each other and a lot more comfortable with a lab where men and women work together on creating the next cool biotechnology breakthrough.
The book is She's Such a Geek, Women Write About Science and Technology and Other Nerdy Stuff. The co-editors are Annalee Newitz and Charlie Anders. Annalee joins us today. Annalee, we only have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and I think I would not be doing the vast amount of other work that you do justice without at least discussing one other area that you've written about recently, which is recommender systems, which is a fascinating area that ultimately deals with the question of data mining of information in order to market products and anything really to consumers. In our very short time left, I think I'll just ask you to define what recommender systems is. And you had this piece in the Washington Post that gives us an object lesson. So perhaps you could talk about that for a few minutes.
Sure. So I did this story for Washington Post partly in response to a contest that Netflix was running. Netflix is a retailer online that allows you to rent DVDs through the mail. And one of the things that Netflix does, because of course they're not a physical store, is they encourage people to rent videos by recommending other titles that they might like based on things that they've rented before. And in fact, about 60% of rentals on Netflix come from these recommendations. And all of the recommendations are being supplied by a software program. So basically, the clerk at the store who you would go to and say, gee, I really want a monster movie that includes tentacles and spaceships, that person who would have immediately told you to go see a Ray Harryhausen movie has been replaced by a software program that will recommend, you know, a movie about a giant octopus to you. So what was interesting to me about that was that this is actually an area that's connected with artificial intelligence and the development of programs that do machine learning, which is a small component of artificial intelligence. And machine learning just refers to any kind of program that can learn from data. So you give it a chunk of data like, here are all the movies that Annalee has ever rented, and it looks at that and it finds patterns, and then it tries to extrapolate from those patterns to other data that it has access to. So in this case, it's very simple because it's all just movie titles. So based on, you know, the 20 monster movies that I rented in the last month, you know, the software says, well, you might like other movies with giant monsters in them. Why don't you try Godzilla versus Ghidorah? which is a great monster movie. So I was interested in that because so many of our scenarios for the development of artificial intelligence are so dystopian, and they're so terrifying. We sort of think of artificial intelligence the way, I suppose you could say, a classic old school geeky boy thinks of women. You know, they're going to invade the workplace and destroy everything with their terrible ways. And you know, we have that same fear about artificial intelligence, that it's going to take our jobs or ruin the world. And in fact, what recommender engines suggest is that really, when we do have artificial intelligence, it's going to be more like a store clerk who's incredibly helpful, and not like Skynet, which is the evil computer in the Terminator movies who destroys everything. I'm interested in it from that perspective, in terms of what would artificial intelligence actually be like if it emerged? And it's likely to emerge in places like this, where we're teaching machines how to anticipate our needs. So that was kind of what intrigued me about it.
And you mentioned it, and again, we can't do it just in the time we have left, but very quickly, you know, we do have this image of technology moving at so fast a pace that human beings would not be able to control it, and that we'd be able to teach computers to reason and ultimately outthink humans. Clearly, that isn't the goal of entities like Amazon and Netflix that want to recommend selling you books. But are you concerned about how this technology, as it currently exists, could be used in ways that perhaps we don't want?
So recommender engines as such, I think that there's a kind of limited applicability for them. I mean, a lot of them are just, again, they really are used for looking at one body of data and then sort of extrapolating connections with another body of data, and then that winds up being a good, you know, movie or book recommendation. But of course, in a broader sense, these kinds of technologies can be used in privacy-invasive ways. This is exactly the same kind of technology that's used for profiling. Intelligence agencies go on phishing expeditions through big chunks of data looking for people who might have, you know, suspicious reading habits or suspicious purchasing habits, this is the kind of technology that they're using. They're looking at patterns in where people have gone, combined with patterns in what they've spent money on, and then the software might extrapolate, well, this person, you know, based on this person's purchases, they might be a terrorist.
Right.
If you're a terrorist, you might like these films. So there is cause for concern. Although, I mean, again, that's, you know, what one would hope that, you know, in that case, we would have policies and laws that would regulate the way in which these pieces of software are used. So in the same way, you know, many kinds of lie detector tests are not admissible in court. There's certain kinds that are, but others are, you know, not considered, you know, evidence enough of lying or of certain kinds of predilections. And one would hope that you'd have those same kinds of regulations in place with these kinds of programs, where a judge would say, great, I'm glad that this program suggested that this suspect might be a terrorist. That isn't really enough evidence to even issue a warrant. You need a lot more evidence than that. So I think that's where we need to be focusing, is looking at how we can create laws that will regulate the way that intelligence agencies use this kind of technology.
On that hopeful note, and certainly I'm one that's skeptical about how regulations deal with these issues, but that's a topic for another day. I want to thank you for definitely being on the show and for educating our listeners on these issues. For those that want to follow your writing and read more of what you do, you mentioned IO9. Is there anywhere else where people can go to find your work?
You can also go to my personal website, which is at annaleenewitz.com. and that I usually post my latest appearances and articles there. So you can follow me there or go to io9.com.
Annalee, thank you so much for being on the show. I certainly invite you back in the future to have this discussion, since you predicted that things would be better in 5 years. Assuming Hearsay Culture is here in 5 years, I certainly invite you back then and hopefully sooner to continue our discussion. But thank you for joining us today on the show.
All right. Sounds good. Bye now.
Take care. I'm very excited to talk with a number of interesting guests coming up this quarter, and these are all people who I think are going to be terrific guests. Among them are Kazis Varnelis from Columbia, who's going to be on discussing his work in communications area. Geert Lovink, who is a technology theorist, will be discussing some of his books, including the book Zero Comments. Alex Halavay, author of the book Search Engine Society from Quinnipiac University. Wendy Chun from Brown University, discussing her book on racial identity and technology. Professors Frank Pasquale and Danielle Citron from Seton Hall Law School and University of Maryland, respectively, will be on the show discussing a fusion center, something related to what we had just chatted about a few minutes ago with Annalee Newitz. Professor Tarleton Gillespie from Cornell University will be on discussing his work in copyright, as well as Professor Elizabeth Townsend Gard from Tulane University School of Law will be on discussing her fascinating project called the Durationator, a project to attempt to make it easy or relatively easy to determine whether a particular work is in is under copyright protection or is not, which for those that are not familiar is a surprisingly very difficult question. Larry Downs will be on as well, discussing his most recent book in business law. And I'm very excited to also mention that Bill Patry, a senior copyright counsel at Google, will be on the show discussing his new book in copyright. There are a number of guests also that are going to be on the show going into the winter quarter. I've recently booked Professor Manuel Castells from University of Southern California and Professor Chris Kelty from UCLA will both be on, and others, all of whom are going to be terrific, and I'm really looking forward to speaking to. For those that want to listen to the show other than live on KZSU at 5 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays, you can pick up the show through our webpage, hearsayculture.com. You can pick up all the previous shows and check out the schedule and see what else is going on in my brain, where I do occasionally put some blog postings up. You can also go to the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, and you can also get the show through CIS's iTunes page by typing Center for Internet Society into the iTunes search engine, and you will find not only Hearsay Culture programming, but all events at CIS. As always, I thank you for listening to the show. I hope you enjoyed this inaugural fall 2009 quarter program. I look forward to talking to you next week. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.